Some people give up liver for Lent. I gave up Diet Coke once. And it was a few years ago. And I learned a lot when I engaged in that Lenten experiment. But before I get to that, I want to share the context for a personal journey that began one Ash Wednesday, the first day of Lent, long, long ago. It serves as a reminder that the time-limited self-examination associated with Lent is paralleled by those struggles, some of which are lifelong, that our Muslim neighbors refer to as jihad. As one who grew up in a humanist Unitarian fellowship, in an era when many among us believed we rational folks knew better than our Christian neighbors, I came to look with a modicum of disdain upon classmates who appeared at school each year one winter Wednesday morning, ashen crosses emblazoned on their foreheads. Decades were to pass before I would realize it was more than that UU elitism of those days, when I would recall an experience that had caused Ash Wednesdays and the days of Lent that followed to be difficult for me for years to come. Ash Wednesdays, you see, were the anniversaries of a deep psychic pain connected with a lifelong sense of exclusion and particularly of a disconnection with Christianity. While ours was not a Catholic family, the only school in my hometown where I was allowed to be enrolled before my fifth birthday was the Catholic school. There, each day of that school year, as my classmates recited their daily prayers, I was required to remain silent. That just became the way things were, that time of silence for me while others engaged in a sense of community. But Ash Wednesday would be remembered years later as the hardest. On a sunny, late winter morning, I was left alone on the cathedral steps on one of the busiest streets in town while my classmates went inside to receive their blessings of ashes. At some point that morning, what at first had seemed a really welcome adventure, alone during school, it turned into a fear-filled event. When those minutes that my classmates were gone began to seem like hours, I summoned the courage to look inside the church. An inner set of doors closed off my view. All I could see was darkness and emptiness. As time went on, I realized years later, the sense of abandonment that I felt that morning melded with the prohibition from daily prayers and contributed to a sense of not belonging, of not being entitled, not just in Christian churches, but in any large groups. It contributed to a sense of not being welcome almost anywhere, and that I was not good enough. Many years after that long ago morning, I enrolled in theological school. I went as an intellectual exercise to think about how it was that psychology and psychotherapy had supplanted religion. Instead, in seminary, I came to believe that we humans need our religions. At Andover Newton, in addition to thinking about religions and religious ideas, we were expected to do a fair amount of self-examination. We were also expected to actually engage in spiritual practices. And just 20 years ago, some of you will remember, that was a pretty novel experience for a UU. Over time, I became fascinated with the ancient roots of so many of the holidays and holy days celebrated around this earth, and with the connections of religious rituals to the seasons of the year and with the seasons of our lives. I grew to appreciate the wisdom shared by the world's religions, the breadth of values held in common, wisdom about what is good and right, certain ideas about how we humans ought to treat each other, and for some, like us, concern about the treatment of all living beings. I grew to appreciate the wisdom concerning practices that sustain and restore the human spirit, practices like mindfulness and prayer, expressions of gratitude, repentance, and forgiveness, words like grace and God that still challenge many of us you use. Conscious of the rites and rituals, of the holidays and holy days, and of the practices, I came to believe that there was a reason that religious leaders throughout history had felt it important to set aside times for reflection, times of the year like Lent, Ramadan, and the Jewish High Holy Days. Having veered from that path of intellectual exploration into parish ministry, early on, I began doing services in which I explored the shared wisdom of the great religions in ritual and concept, of Kuan Yin and compassion, of Mahashivaratri, a Hindu holiday that begins with ritualistic intention and the expression of gratitude for simply being, and eventually, that one time, an experiment with Lent. And then, after 9/11, we were to hear a great deal about the concept of jihad. The word jihad has a very simple meaning. It means simply to struggle, to make a great effort. The struggle can be inward and spiritual or outward and material. The greater jihad, it is believed, is the inner jihad. The struggle to come to terms with oneself and one's experiences, with one's community, to be in right relationship. It is considered far more difficult, the greater jihad is considered far more difficult than the lesser jihad. In the lesser jihad, the struggle is turned outward. That outward struggle, as we know, can involve the force of arms. But hear these comments on the inner jihad from some interpreters, students of Islam. The greater jihad involves the effort of each one of us to become a better human being, to struggle to improve him or herself. It's fighting the self, resisting the worst in oneself, and offering the best of one's being. It is the most difficult, the most noble, and the jihad that requires the most understanding, forgiveness, and sincerity to oneself. It requires humility and an awareness of one's fragility. The greater jihad, writes Karen Armstrong, is the infinitely more momentous and urgent challenge to reform our own societies and our own hearts. A most excellent kind of jihad, the Prophet Muhammad is believed to have said, is to carry on against your own self and whim for the sake of the good. And so here we are at this turning time of the year, this Lenten time. Throughout most of this past week, month, year, it was bitter cold, complete with sleet, snow, and chill winds. But there have been a few hints of spring. Yesterday, the temperature soared, relatively, topping off at, 50 degrees? The most springly day for me, though, was about 10 days ago. It was a Tuesday. I had an appointment that morning for a haircut. When I left the salon, I took maybe 2 steps, then stopped short, took a deep breath, and stood in awe. The sky was blue. The air actually touched with the warmth of spring. I had not noticed the two women who were approaching me to the right. until one of them, a large woman, looked rather suspiciously at me and scolded, "Well, I'm not that wide." I was surprised and smiled. No, it's definitely not you. It is this day. It is so beautiful. Soon we three were sharing the joy of a day that was a harbinger of spring. That meeting may have been a bit like the Indians celebrating Holi, without the paint. Sharing the joy of being out in the fresh air, lighter in mood and free of the weight of winter wraps, open to engaging with strangers. That five-minute meeting might serve as well as a metaphor for Lent, as I understand it in my Unitarian Universalist way. Mindful of winter's darkness, the outer and the inner one, the one that grips our spirits. Gripped by our life experiences and how we have interpreted them, we are called to turn inward, to reflect on the hurts we have perpetrated and upon the ways we have been hurt. We are called to an inner struggle that we may ultimately be in right relationship with ourselves, with others, and with that which is greater. Lent offers a time-limited opportunity to slow down, to reflect, to explore winter's chill, to repent, to forgive, and to be reconciled. During Lent, we might say we are invited to engage in a time-limited jihad. The wisdom of the great religions is that we come together at these designated times in community, recognizing that we are all wounded, that we need to set aside these times during which we reflect. We may call these holidays and holy days by different names, but we engage in the struggle together. We are there for each other. We take each other's hands and cross those bridges from darkness to light, from death to life, from life to death, from winter's depths to the breath of springtime in our souls, to new beginnings. And so I recall the springtime of my great Lenten experiment. Did you know that Lent means spring? That's it, spring. And that's why some call it the springtime of the soul. Giving up Diet Coke seemed almost frivolous at the time, but it also seemed like something I could do. And I wanted to try this ritual, this practice. And getting to that moment when I would engage in any Lenten practice had been significant. For when the hurts are deep, as with my experience in that Catholic kindergarten, or for some of us, the hurts perpetrated by family members or classmates or even the people we meet on the street, we create emotional barriers that prevent us from knowing our own feelings, from knowing the source of some of our own angers or fears or sorrows. For me, it is unlikely that I ever would have put the pieces together had I not gone to seminary, done the personal emotional work, and then the intellectual exploration, and especially had I not become a parish minister and had to write sermons, which caused me to discover what I think and feel, and then to share these explorations with you. When I gave up Diet Coke, besides knowing it would be good for me and believing it was something I could do, there was that time limit, 40 days in the desert. Surely, I believed, I could give up this habitual bit of self-indulgence for 40 days. It wasn't long, though, before, in mid-morning, when it came time for my daily jolt of caffeine, I began yearning for a Diet Coke. At first, I would chastise myself and grit my teeth. I can do this, I would say. But after a few days, and in the context of doing this as a Lenten practice, I began thinking about all the people on this earth for whom the cost of a Diet Coke might be a day's wage. Or I drink water instead of soda and feel a sense of gratitude for having clean water, not only to drink, but to bathe in. I felt a sense of righteousness, too, that I was really getting through this. I also felt angry at the injustice of news that had come out that winter about wealthy Western corporations represented at a UN conference on water. They had been there buying future water rights of developing countries. When we give up something that has been habitual, whether it's a favorite food or drink or that behavior, swearing or gossiping, we are giving up an aspect of the rhythm of our life. And that causes discomfort. We like having what we want when we want it, whether it's good for us or not. But more than that, when we give up something, we just might behave in ways we aren't particularly proud of, like being reactive, short-tempered, grumpy, and we may not even realize that that's what that's about. Giving up Diet Coke for Lent caused me to become conscious then, not only of thoughts and feelings associated with not having a Diet Coke every day, but also of my behavior and attitudes related to much more, and much more intently and intentionally than ever on the countless diets I've gone on or when I quit smoking years ago. Giving up Diet Coke in the context of a spiritual practice gave the action a sense of higher purpose and invited consideration of higher values. Giving up something for Lent as a spiritual practice just may cause us to think about other things we might want to change, things we ought to give up, things we might wish we had said or not said, words or actions we regret and for which we might wish to make amends, ways of being that we might want to change for the long term. We might think of Lent as that time-limited jihad, a time during which we struggle with ourselves. But then there are the jihads, the struggles in which we are called to engage throughout our lives, that we may be reconciled, that we may find peace, that we may be in right relationship with ourselves and that which is greater and outside us. And so I recall one summer morning not so long ago, I was visiting my mother in South Dakota. I had awakened just before dawn, dressed, tiptoed down the hall, and slipped quietly out the door. That morning, I made a walking pilgrimage past significant places of my youth, my grammar school, houses that had been the homes of my friends, the house in which I had spent my earliest years, and finally to that cathedral just over the hill from that house, upon whose steps I had sat so long ago. Doors that had been closed to me and windows that had seemed so dark, not just that morning, but every time I passed the cathedral for years, windows that seemed so dark were wide open that spring morning as Mass was just beginning. I squared my shoulders, readied myself for rejection, and with great determination, I walked up those steps. When I stepped into that space that had been so dark and foreboding, no one stopped me. And it was like walking into the inside of a big Baroque jewel box. Angels were carved in the ceilings and on the walls, and everything was painted white and gold. The music was beautiful, I breathed in the song of the morning, turned, and walked outside. Although it was summer, for me, it was a springtime for my soul. A new beginning, a time of reconciliation. And no one else knew it. If we take seriously the inclusive nature of the sources of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we will be called to be in right relationship with ourselves, each other, our neighbors, and that which is greater, with that which cannot be named. It doesn't mean we need to believe what adherents of other faiths believe, or that we need to accept the doctrines of those faiths. It means exactly what it says. We will look to the wisdom. The journey that began for me one late winter Wednesday morning, the first day of Lent, almost a lifetime ago, led to a great inner jihad. A struggle with myself about who I was, a struggle with an institution whose tenets of that long ago time had caused me psychic harm, a struggle with God. How could I accept the universalist God of love when some of God's most powerful representatives on earth had shut me out? A decades-long struggle that contributed to some inexplicable anger and grief, the letting go of which happened one summer morning and brought the breath of springtime, as I said, brought the breath of springtime to my soul. The Reverend Max Coutts, beloved among many of us, by many of us, and now gone, wrote, "On calendars, the seasons march in pat procession across neat numbered months. For me and others of my ilk, the seasons are not just holidays of green or white. I sometimes sense some stronger seasons in myself, where time is rearranged as something clocks could never tell, a time in some subjective order all its own. If there is any sense to seasons, then it is this, that time is timeless, and time is life. Not spring, nor summer, not even fall is gone. Each will be what it becomes, as winter will be spring."